So today, the goal is to conclude the discussion of the Ising model, because now that we computed some exact results for the Ising model, is a good time to try to summarize what we have seen and how general these results are. And hopefully we'll start with the last topic of these lectures, which are the study of another statistical mechanical class of problems, which are polymers or self-avoiding walks. Okay, so paths that don't self-intersect. But before, let me make a few comments. So first, one comment is that over these lectures, we already saw many so-called critical exponents. So here, they are in circles, and they appear, for example, the kind of cartoon that we always have for a critical exponent is how does the magnetization vanish as I approach the critical temperature? And we saw in the Ising model, for example, it's 1 over 8. For example, I don't remember, I think in the front end, you did some mean field analysis, right? So you saw what is mean field? It's an approximation, right? Where in mean field, you say that instead of having spins interacting, I and J, you make an approximation and say spin I roughly sees the neighbors as an average. So he interacts with the others effectively as a magnetization. Right? So Si times Sj becomes Si times the magnetization, because we think that Si, because of so many neighbors, he effectively measures the magnetization there. And so we make this approximation of mean field, where the spin I sees the spin on average, right? And then we compute, it's an approximation scheme, and for example, this exponent there comes out as 1/2, if I remember correctly. Okay? So there, it's an approximation, it's not exactly correct in that case. Okay. And so these exponents in the Ising model, for example, the way the magnetization vanishes, but also the way correlation functions behave at large distances at the critical temperature, namely they decay algebraically with a power of 1/2. Another is, what does it mean to be at the critical temperature in terms of the correlation length? It blows up. How does it blow up? With a power 1, that's another critical exponent. And I emphasize that this behavior is strikingly different from what we would call the free spin model, which would be the Gaussian model, where I just have some spins that are unconstrained. They go from minus to plus infinity. There, instead of this behavior, we'll get a very different behavior. It will be logarithmic. In other words, it's r to the power 0 instead of 1 over 4. And I say that's not a small correction. It's not like this is this plus a small correction plus small. It's really very different. And then I used the word that I was told that people were confused in the tutorial. I used the word quantum. I said it's a big quantum correction. And people were confused because it's a statistical mechanics course. What is he talking about? Quantum? What's quantum? There's nothing quantum. And indeed, it's because we are so used to alternating between quantum and classical that we use both words, and I use both words interchangeably. So here, the way we should really say, if we are strictly rigorous, is that we have it's not a small, yeah, we should. It is not, right, there is nothing. Be careful, yeah? Not, it's not a small thermal fluctuation, right? It's not, this is not just a small fluctuation. It's really a big fluctuation. The system fluctuates a lot. That's what we call it strongly coupled, right? So this would be the correct words. And that's when we are doing Euclidean physics, like we are doing, right? Our lattice is two-dimensional Euclidean space, right? So there is x and y, and we are in two dimensions. If we were to change these dimensions into 1 plus 1 and say 1 is time, 1 is space, then we go to Lorentzian space, what we would call quantum statistical fluctuations would become quantum fluctuations. Okay? And that's why sometimes I jump and I say big quantum fluctuations. Implicitly, I went to Lorentzian space. Or I stay in Lorentzian, in Euclidean, and then it's thermal fluctuations. But let's just say fluctuations. So the system can fluctuate a little. If there is a small parameter and we can compute fluctuations and they are small, or it can fluctuate a lot. And in this case, it fluctuates a lot. That's what we call a strongly coupled system. Yes?
So this may be kind of dumb, but everyone always speaks of like quantum mechanics or is the same as a statistical classical mechanics. So what in that duality, what happens when you consider statistical models which are quantum? Like those statistical quantum mechanics models have something to do with.
So whenever you have a sum over configurations, if you have a temperature, you can weak rotate and get a time. So there's always this connection between a classical statistical mechanical model and a quantum statistical mechanical model. Now you can also have dualities between quantum models, because you could have a statistical mechanical partition function that itself describes a quantum system, right? And then by means of changing one of the directions into time, you get a quantum system. Okay? But you see, it's why do we say this is classical? This, we are summing over energies of these spins, right? I mean, these spins, their interaction is a quantum effect, right? So they have some spin-spin interaction because of quantum effects. So we are summing energies of my quantum system, say. It just so happens that the energies are very simple and they are just given by spins up or down, right? So we could say that the system is quantum and we are computing the partition function because we are computing the energies. Now, if we swap one of the directions by time, we are studying a quantum model that is not the two-dimensional model. It's a model in one dimension where the other dimension is reinterpreted as time. Okay, so there are two quantum models there, the one-dimensional model and the original two-dimensional model that we were summing over its energies. Okay? But in this language, we are just summing over configuration and fluctuations, let's call them thermal. So let's not use the word quantum. If I use, ignore it. Just replace my empty sequence. Yes.
So if you replace your spin plug polymatrices or something like this, how does that relate to this picture?
No, that was Ivan's question. So if I replace this, if I consider a model where, if my Hamiltonian is hard to diagonalize, I still compute sum over the states e to the minus beta energy of that state. It is just that the map from configurations to the energies is more complicated. Whenever I can achieve this map, and whenever I can write as a sum over configurations, and when I have two directions, I can convert one into time, and I get now a quantum mechanical system in one less dimension. Okay. Anyway, really, for the purpose of these lectures, I just want you to ignore whenever I say quantum. I mean fluctuation. Now, let me emphasize in particular a big difference that is now going to be important in what I'm going to explain, which is that this correlation function goes to zero, whereas this correlation function goes to infinity at large radius, right? So it's a big difference. Notice also that in the Gaussian model, if we are not in d equals 2, but if we are in d bigger than 2, it actually goes to 0, like the Ising model in two dimensions. Right? So we have two guys that go to 0, and one that goes to infinity. Okay? And this thing going to infinity is telling us that the x, this sx and this sy, it will never be a good approximation to say they are a small fluctuation, because we start separating the distance and they start growing and growing and growing, this correlation function. So it's not going to be a good approximation to say that these fields are small, because we just compute a two-point function and see that the two-point function grows. Okay? So this will have important consequences in what we're going to discuss now. So now I would like to review this table that I presented last time, but it was very fast at the very end, so let's recall what we saw. The statement is, when can we have order? It doesn't mean we have order. It's when we can have order, right? So if the temperature is very big, we don't have order. Right? We heat up the system a lot, it just melts, right, and breaks. So when can we have order? When in d equal 1, we never have order. Because basically, kinks, domain walls between two states, it costs the energy of just a boundary between the two states, because we are in one dimension. So the energy cost is order 1. But we can put these boundaries in many positions, and so the entropy always wins, right? And if it's a continuous symmetry, the energy of the wall might be even smaller than 1. It only helps the entropy, right? So in d equals 1, our argument immediately says, no, you can never have order. Entropy will always win. What about d equals 2? In d equals 2, we saw that the entropy, which is the log of the number of states, and the number of ways of making a loop around the domain was mu to some power of the length of the domain, where mu was some number that he said is between log 2 over 4 and 3. And so the entropy grows like L. The energy also goes like the length of the boundary, because at each point of the boundary, it is just the spin connection. And therefore, there is a competition. So yes, we can have order. Whether we have or not depends on the critical temperature. Right? Now, there, it was already borderline. Right? It worked because both were of the same order. So it should not be of a surprise if I tell you that when I go to a continuous symmetry, now the entropy wins. Because when I have a continuous symmetry, it's easier to change from one state to the other without an energy cost. So let's just work it out a little bit carefully, just to see. I just want to work out this thing. Okay, sorry. In D equals 2, continuum symmetry. In that table there. Okay, so let's do this. So let's suppose that now we have a domain. And in this domain, the spins are pointing in this direction. And then here in this domain, they are pointing in this direction outside. And then there is a transition region that has some thickness. And in this region, the spins change. From one direction to the other. And so this region, if this size is L, this region can be of order L. It can be like L over 20, L over 100, right? So we have a big region, and we have a domain wall of 1% of that region. Now, let's suppose we have this domain wall. What would be the energy cost of this configuration? Now, remember, spins aligned is a minimum, right? Spins aligned is a minimum. And therefore, this spin configuration here, right? This spin is equal to this spin plus order 1 over L. Okay, so first of all, why is this true? Because by definition, I'm saying that I go of order L and I change by order 1. So each time I change a little bit, I change by order 1 over L. Do you agree? Each spin differs by the other one by order 1 over L, such that in total I get an order 1 change. Okay, good. So that's these neighbors. So what's the energy cost of this configuration here? And the claim is that this energy, therefore, is of order 1 over L squared. Why? Because, again, both aligned is a minimum. So fluctuations around the minimum don't have linear term, they have quadratic term. Another way of saying is that this vector, this being aligned is the maximum, and when I make a small variation, the variation is perpendicular to the vector, and therefore S dot delta S is equal to 0. Right? And therefore, the energy cost of a little bit is of order L squared. Right? This is the energy cost of this little bit. And now we have length of order L here, and thickness of order L, so this leads to an energy of order 1. Right? So we have L squared, okay, this is in a little bit. Therefore, the energy in the full strip is of order 1. And we are done. And therefore, the entropy wins, right? Because the entropy doesn't change. The entropy is just, the entropy is still going to be L log mu, and therefore wins. Okay, so we are done. Right. Before, both were of order L. This was of order L. This was of order L. There was a competition. And now we just saw that because we can change it smoothly, the energy cost is just of order 1. And therefore, in that case, that was borderline. Now we cannot have order in two dimensions. It's not possible. Okay? Good. So that's what we wanted to establish. Now let's see it in another way. And this is called the Mermin-Wigner theorem. That says the same thing. But let's see how we would go about seeing this theorem. So this theorem says that there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking in D equals 2. No continuous spontaneous symmetry breaking in D equals 2. In other words, this configuration is going to be, this order is destroyed. even though energetically it's good to have all spins aligned, if we have a continuous symmetry, this order is destroyed. Okay, which is what we saw here in this argument, but let's see how it would go about in equations. So let's suppose it is not destroyed and reach a contradiction, and then we see that it is destroyed. Okay, so let's suppose, it was not destroyed. Suppose it was ordered. In other words, my spin would be equal to spin up plus fluctuations. Where these fluctuations, we are assuming they are small. The thermal fluctuations. If I say quantum, ignore quantum. So plus fluctuations. Okay, good. So what does it mean in formulas? So let's suppose that we have our vector S. Let's suppose we are in the ON model, where in the ON model, let's say that I'm using S squared equal to 1. In some lecture it was N, but that doesn't matter, it's just a rescaling. So saying that it's pointing more or less up would be, for example, one way of describing would be, let's say that the parametrization would be 1 minus sigma squared sigma. And the statement that it's approximately pointing up is the statement that this vector sigma of n minus 1 components is small. Right? So we say that S is equal to this with sigma small. Right? Then S is pointing up, right? So it's up plus a small tangent fluctuation that is parameterized by this sigma. Right? So we have our vector in our sphere. In the ON model, and the vector is approximately here plus a small fluctuation sigma. Okay, and then we take that and we plug this into our action, which was, so our energy, which was SI dot SI plus 1, right, sum over, sorry, SI SJ. Sum over neighbors. With some coupling. Which I can write as sum. Let me see the following. This is equal to a constant, approximately equal, to a constant plus the integral over, let's put d dimensions, over a d dimensional lattice, if we are in d dimensions, times the derivative of s squared. So what have I done here? So it doesn't look to be the case because I have SI dot SI plus 1. To make a derivative, I also need SI square and I also need SJ square. But those are constants in the ON model, right? So I add and subtract what I need to make a derivative. And therefore, in the continuum limit, when the spin changes little from I to I plus 1, this expression is approximately equal to this expression. Okay? Is it good? So all we did here is notice that the term which I'm missing to construct the derivatives are just SI square and SJ square, but by assumption, S square is on the sphere, and so those terms are constants. So I can just add a constant to my energy. So that's this constant here. And now we are saying that I plug this S that I computed there, here, and therefore the result I get is constant plus j times an integral d dx of del sigma squared. Okay, del, and this is the same thing. It's the same, del mu del mu. Okay? So I just plug the expression plus order sigma to the 4. We assume that sigma is small, so to leading order, I just replace s by sigma. The first component doesn't matter, which is to say that this tangent shift is much bigger than how much you go down here, right? Because you are at an orthogonal. Now remember that this vector is constrained. This vector s squared is equal to 1. This sigma is not constrained. This sigma is just the tangent vector to the north pole. Right? So here we start with s squared equal to 1, and here we have sigma, which is an n minus 1 dimensional unconstrained vector. Okay. And now, right, so this vector, what is the now the correlation function of sigma at position x and sigma at position y? Well, this is nothing but a Gaussian model, because now sigma is unconstrained. So we have a Gaussian model in sigma. So this is nothing but the Gaussian model. So this is equal to that expression over there, integral d dq. Sorry, if I have sigma component A, sigma component B, is equal to integral d dq to pi to the d. The component A and B need to be the same, e to the I, q dot r, and here q square. And if we are careful, the Gaussian is the inverse, there is a 1 over j here. For the propagator. All good? Here? This is the same type of propagator that you have encountered in quantum field theory when you have a free scalar. Here we have just n minus 1 independent scalars, right? This is d sigma 1 squared, d sigma 2 squared, d sigma 3 squared. So for each of them, I have the traditional propagator. And you see that there is no mass term here. It is only this derivative. And therefore, I get just q squared. Right? In Fourier, if I go to Fourier, right, this object, let me just do one more step here. I could say that this object in Fourier is just integral d dq of q squared times sigma of q and sigma minus q, right? Because derivatives are just q's, just bring down q's. So and then the Gaussian is just saying that they inverse. Now the modes are all decoupled, and I get just 1 over q squared. Right? Okay. And therefore, this object, like this, now you see that we start to see something important, that now depending on the dimension, as we saw there, this object goes to 0 if d is bigger than 2, and this object goes to infinity if d is equal to 2. And so we start saying, we said that sigma was a small fluctuation, and now we compute its fluctuation and we see it goes to infinity. Right? So that violates our assumption that sigma was small. Right? So this doesn't look like something small. And therefore, the assumption that we broke the symmetry and that we had 1 plus something small seems to break down. And therefore, we cannot start with that assumption that the vector is approximately 1. Okay. But let's see it even more physically. Let's make this sharper. We don't like infinities. Let's make this a little bit sharper. So let's compute, for example, we said that it's approximately 1. So what would be the magnetization? Well, the magnetization would be, for example, the expectation value of the first component of S, which is 1 minus 1 half expectation value of sigma square plus dot, 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 if I expand the square roots, right? So this is just square root 1 minus sigma square expanded at small sigma, right? And therefore, the result for my magnetization is related to the expectation value of sigma square. Okay, so that's very easy. I just put y equal x. This is r equal to 0. I just put a equal to b, and I sum over a and b. And therefore, the result that I get is that this is equal to 1 minus 1 half integral d dq over 2 pi to the d times 1 over q square. Now I have no r dependence here. And you see that this integral in radial coordinates, it's just proportional to the integral q square q dq, sorry, q to the d minus 1 dq. And you see therefore that in d equals to 2, it diverges logarithmically at r at small q. And if d is bigger than 2, it is finite. And so we see that this guy is finite, right? It's finite for d bigger than 2, but it's infinite for d equals to 2. Now, what does it mean, infinite? It couldn't be infinite. We said in the first lecture, if we have infinity, we are not understanding something. Everything is finite. It's a lattice, right? So what would be the exact computation? If we had done the exact computation, instead of an integral, we would have the sum of the Brillouin zone. And it's the smallest moment of that Brillouin zone that would contribute. So what we mean by infinity, strictly speaking, if we had kept a lattice regulator from the beginning, is that it just blows up with the length of the system, right? So in other words, it blows up with the length of my system. Right, it's the smallest momenta, it's like 2 pi over L that would give the cutoff there. But the conclusion would be the same nonetheless, which is that we assumed it's a small fluctuation, the magnetization was approximately 1, and we see, no, not really. This expectation value of S1 actually fluctuates a lot, and it's by no means just close to 1. It's very far from 1 if you are in d equals to 2. And therefore, the assumption that it was 1 plus something small is really not okay. So that just confirms our intuition, and this is what's called this Mermin-Wagner theorem. And so the general intuition, even more general, is what's called Goldstone's theorem, which is to say we had a symmetry, right? So we had a symmetry. And we decided to say that the vacuum chooses some direction. But it could have chosen any other direction. What is the difference of energy between all speeds pointing like this or like this? 0. If all of them are pointing in the same direction, it's the same thing. That's what it means to have a symmetry. And so there is a mode that corresponds to shifting the spins from this direction to this direction that should be a massless mode because it costs no energy to move from one configuration to the other. So there should be no gap corresponding to that energy cost. And so the statement is whenever you have a symmetry breaking, you have a massless particle which corresponds to shifting from one vacuum to the other. But massless particles in two dimensions are pathological because they just fluctuate like crazy. And so they cannot exist in two dimensions, and therefore you cannot break symmetry in two dimensions. In higher dimension, can you? Yes, you can break symmetry in higher dimensions. You break it, and then you do have these massless modes because you could have broken in any possible direction. And massless modes are okay in higher dimensions, and there is no problem. Okay? So that's the summary of that table. Let me make one important comment, which you could have complained. Yes.
So the picture of this particle, is that in the quantum and thermal picture, or just the quantum field theory?
No, it's the same thing. We just replace massless by particle with infinite correlation length. Let me just make a comment that you could be a little bit surprised that we had a symmetry S to minus S. So how come M is not equal to 0? Right? Because we sum over configurations, and for each configuration with some spins, there is another with minus the spins. So how could we get a magnetization that is non-zero at all? And that's true. In magnetic systems, if we wait the age of the universe, eventually the magnetization is zero. But that's because we have to wait times that are exponentially large in the size of the system. So indeed, if you have a magnet and all spins are pointing up, if you wait exponential of the volume of the magnet, eventually, by thermal fluctuation, they flip down. Right? But that's exponential of an exponentially large number. It's like age of the universe, so it doesn't happen. Okay? So what does it mean, mathematical? Now, this is the physical statement. Mathematical, it means that it depends how you take the limit. If you take the limit first, sending the length to infinity, now you cannot go from one vacuum to the other, because it took exponential of a volume to go from one vacuum to the other. So if you take that volume to infinity, now you are stuck in one of the vacuum. Okay? And then you could obtain a finite magnetization. In other words, let's suppose that we do the following. We consider that we compute the expectation value of our spin Si, and we take some magnetic field and we send it to zero. Okay, now we send it to zero, it's zero. Now that it's zero, this expectation value is zero. And therefore, if afterwards I take the limit, when the size of the system goes to infinity, it continues to be zero because limit of zero is zero. And so this result is zero. However, if I start by saying that I take first the size of the system to go to infinity, and then I take the limit where the magnetic field that starts positive goes to zero, I turn it off, then if I send it to zero plus minus, this would go to plus minus the magnetization. Okay? So that's the physical picture, which is that you help the system a little bit, you kick a small epsilon to just say, yeah, break the symmetry in this direction. It breaks, and then you turn it off, and it survives this small break. Now, here we said very tiny magnetic field. There are many equivalent ways of doing this. You could also, for example, have a big lattice, and at the boundary, set the boundary conditions that the spins are up, for example, at the boundary. Right? Then you first take the size to infinity, and then you would remain with a finite magnetization. Okay? So it always depends on the way we take this limit. So if the system is very big, the fluctuations around positive magnetization will never talk to the fluctuations around negative magnetization. Okay? So mathematically, there is an order of limits, and physically, it's the fact that we have two minima that are very far away, so it's exponentially long time to tunnel, so the time would be some exponential of minus the volume to tunnel from one vacuum to the other. If we were to wait long enough, sampling configurations and trying to see when will I jump from one vacuum to the other, it would eventually take an exponentially long time. Okay? This time could be really your computer time if you are simulating this sum over states by Monte Carlo, say, where you are randomly taking states, boom, 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 and until you get the other vacuum, it will take exponentially long time. So you are safe, you stay in one vacuum and you stay there. Okay, so finally, the last comment that I would like to make is a very simple one, this compared to the other ones, which is about universality. I want to emphasize one point. There's one more point I would like to make before. One more comment I would like to make. So this is one comment. And the next comment, still about the Ising model, is about what happens when I turn on the magnetic fields. And we said what the answer is in the language of summing over sticks, right? Let's think, what would it be in the language of summing over domains? Because it's actually even easier there. So in the language of summing over domains, I remind you that we just described the configuration of Ising model by just drawing domains that separate spins plus from spins minus. So I start with plus, and immediately whenever I find the wall, I flip the spins, right? So by drawing a picture of any loops, I know immediately what the configurations are. You agree? Now, what would happen if the magnetic field is non-zero? Well, now, remember that we said that the energy, we said that the energy of everyone up, say, was equal to J times the volume. Right? But now there is an extra term, plus H times the volume. Right? Or maybe here it was two, because there was twice as many links as sites. Right? And then the energy of a configuration would be, I could write as the energy of this configuration plus the energy relative to that configuration. And that's how we saw before that this energy was 2J times the length of the loop. Right? When we have a loop, right? The energy is measured around the loop, because inside the loop and outside the loop, the spins are all the same, and therefore that energy is already here. But now what do we get if we have a magnetic field? And if I have a magnetic field, and what do I get now? An extra term. Exactly. So now we have the length of the loop, and now we will have plus magnetic field times the area of the loop. Right? Because now each spin inside, or maybe twice magnetic field, right? Because we measure relative to the same. Or the volume, yeah, we're calling it volume. It's okay. Doesn't matter. But you see that we have now a problem where we could indeed write a model of loops, but where we would have to take into account not just the length of the loop and the winding of the loop, but the area enclosed by the loop, right? So we would have to take into account, we could sum over the loop, that we could do, we could even study self-intersections and so on. So we managed to solve this problem of computing this NL. But now what we would need to do is add the area to this construction. So take away that you measure the area as well. That's what we need, right? Okay, and this is not known, I just want to say. Okay, so we don't know how to measure the area of the full loop in a closed way. So we don't know. So that breaks this Markovian nature that we have to describe these paths. If I want to sum over the path, then the area is a very global thing that after I have the path, I could compute it. But we have no way of efficiently summing over paths with the area included, right? So we don't know how to do this. Sum over all closed loops minus 1 to the winding of the loop plus 1 times V to the length of the loop times mu to the area of the loop. If we, as soon as we put this mu, we don't know how to length of the loop, winding of the loop. As soon as we put some area factor, some chemical potential to measure the area, this mu would be e to the 2h. As soon as we put it, we don't know how to compute. But this would be what we would need. This would be related to logarithm of the partition function of Ising with magnetic field. But this is not known. We don't know how to compute this one. So it's a nice problem that is still open. Now, let me just emphasize something important, which is that, again, TC is not universal. For example, triangular lattice, hexagonal lattice, it was more complicated to compute it, right? And for the square lattice, it was the square root of 2 minus 1 in the case of the Ising model. However, these critical exponents are expected to be universal. and not depend, because it's a long distance physics, and not depend on the precise details. In other words, it should be like in the various examples that we saw before. In the Gaussian model, we said add extra small couplings, go to large distances, they are washed out. Random walks, add some small, start with a complicated probability distribution, go to large distances, it goes to the Gaussian, it's washed out. Here as well, the precise details on how the spins are coupled, what lattice, and so on, go to large distances, and those details should be washed out. Okay? And that's indeed what we see. And in particular, that means that we can describe many systems at once, that we can predict that if you compute these correlation functions that they decay with this power 1 over 4 and 1 and 1 over 8 for many physical systems, provided they are in what we call the same universality class. So let me give you just an example. So for example, we could have an Ising model where I have a spin Si equal plus minus 1. But I could also have a gas where at each side, the site could be empty, or there could be a particle there. And I have my lattice, and most sites could be empty, and some sites could be occupied. And then we could imagine that I put these particles, and if two particles are occupied, I would say that now, in this language, I have an occupation, let's say sigma I, which is 0 or 1, whereas here the spin I was plus or minus 1. And now here I could have some Hamiltonian, where there could be, for example, some energy penalty for putting particles I and J neighboring to each other, and this could cost some energy, let's say epsilon. And there could also be some chemical potential plus mu, right, conjugate to putting particles, sum over I, where this would be just the particle number. Right, so I put some box, and there is some chemical potential, and the number of particle changes. Right? So that's a model of a gas. And I could have here, by this, I mean some neighbors. It doesn't need to be just nearest neighbors. It could be nearest neighbors, next to nearest neighbors. Then there would be different constants and so on. But notice that this is just our Ising model. It's nothing but the Ising model. If I just redefine sigma I to be Si plus 1, 1 minus Si over 2. Then I just expand this and I get Ising model plus a constant. And so this model that just describes the gas, where at each point I can have a particle or not a particle, is in the same universality class as the Ising model. And so what are the, how do the parameters go? So in the Ising model, we had two key quantities, which was the magnetic field and the temperature. Right? What do we have when we have a gas? We have the pressure and the temperature. Those are the two key quantities. And indeed, if you work out, you see that the pressure is, that indeed you have to tune the pressure and the temperature to go to the critical point in the same way as you had to tune the magnetic field to zero and the temperature to the critical temperature to go to the magnetic critical point. And therefore, we learned that the phase transition close to the, when the correlation length is large, the correlation, the behavior we expect for this type of gas, where we have a gas where particles interact when they are nearby, is given by the same critical exponents as those of magnetic models. Right? So for example, if you study the three-dimensional Ising model, you are also studying the transition that describes the liquid vapor phase transition in water. Right? Where the transition between having magnetization or not would be a transition between having a finite density or a very small density. Okay? Which would be like a liquid and a gas. Another model that would be in the same universality class, so that's one model. This is another model. And yet another model would be, for example, if I would have my Hamiltonian, which would be say I sum over I, Sj, where these guys are real. So this is like just a Gaussian model. That's not the Ising model. Okay. But then I say that, for example, there is some potential V of Si, and I sum over I, where this potential would have two minima, one around minus one, one around plus one. So that the excitation, so that this Si in practice, it wants to be here or here. So even though we started with a continuous model, then by a potential, we are forcing the configurations to be mostly here or mostly here. Otherwise, this energy is energetically not favored. And therefore, this would have the same type of physics as the Ising model or the gas. And in the continuum limit, this, as we saw before, would be like a scalar. I have a I have a scalar, which could describe a, and some put some nonlinearity here, some potential. Okay? So I have like a scalar at each point of a lattice, and then a potential with two stable positions, one at minus one, one at plus one. Okay? This could be, for example, you know, when you have these pieces of metal and they have two stable positions, like pong, pong. So suppose you have something like this. We have a table. And at each point of the at each point of this table, you have the height of the table. And suppose that the height has two stable positions, like plus or minus A. Right? And then you have an interaction between nearest particles of the table. Right? And when you hit the table, you have these waves of these phonons of the table. Then it will be described by a model like this. Exactly. You have a scalar, nearest neighbor interaction, and then, for example, two stable points, if the table likes to be at two different positions. And so the same model that will describe fluctuations on when I am in a vacuum here, what's the likelihood that I'm in the other vacuum here, and so on, would be in the same universality class as the spin model, that would be in the same universality class as the gas. Right? And so statistical mechanics, they have this, and physics in general, with this universality, we have this power that we describe many models at once. Again, when we are describing distances much bigger than the lattice spacing. Of course, if the distances are comparable to the lattice spacing, then we are not doing statistical physics, we are doing microscopy, right? And then we see the lattice. We see if it's a triangular lattice or a square lattice, then of course it matters. How could it not? Okay, so I think this concludes this subject, and I think now we switch to this other problem of studying random walks, the sum, the statistical mechanics of paths that don't self-intersect. So it's a good point to ask questions if you have questions about any of this. Please think while I raise the blackboards.
For the area. Which step, like the area we have been going on to?
Sorry?
So you said that the area was a not local thing?
Yeah, it's hard to capture in a. To say that, it's hard to capture the area. If I just give you. If I give you the full path, of course you draw it and you see the area. The question is, it's hard to compute by how much did the area change by giving one step.
If I just imagine it's a function I integrate, it doesn't work.
No. No, first it's not a function.
Yes, okay.
Even if it was a function, I don't think it would work because imagine I'm here and I'm going here. So you could say that, for example, this part of the path, if I'm assuming that I'm going somewhere here, this path looks easy, right? Whenever I give a step, I just measure this area because it depends on the previous path. But how am I going to do when I reach here? This depends on how I will eventually close it here, right? Now I'm here and I want to know from here to here by how much did the area change? And I don't know because that still depends on future history, right? If I do like this, then this area is very big, right? That if later I decide to do like this, then this area is much smaller.
And if at the origin I draw a line and I integrate, and if I say that when I go right, I integrate, it adds positive contribution. If I go left, it goes negative contribution.
I'm not saying it cannot be done. I'm saying that no one managed to do it yet. But of course, people should try. Yeah, I don't have a no-go theorem that all constructions don't work. I hope one of them does. I would love to. I tried for 1 hour, but 1 hour is not much, right? You should try for a week, and then you see if it works or not. Okay. Any other question? Is there any point that is not clear, even if you don't have a sharp question? Do you want me to repeat some point, or is everything clear so far?
If they're in the same universality class, how do you know that they share all the same critical exponents rather than just a handful of them?
So we don't. The answer is we don't. So we guess, and then we check. So when we have a lattice model, what's going to happen at large distance is going to be a field theory. And then it so turns out that when you write field theories compatible with the symmetries of your problem, there are a finite number of so-called relevant operators that matter at large distances. So you have a finite number of options. Now, because you have just a finite number of options, there are a few universality classes. So you guess that your models, you start the way we would draw it, is we say I start with all these different lattice models. I have the gas, I have Ising model, I have my two vacuum SI belonging to real model. And then at large distances, they flow. If I go to the RG, they flow to the same universality class. Right? Now, for example, we know that close to this, there is an example where we have no potential, and that flows to another universality class. That flows to the Gaussian model. So here, I would have to guess, what if the potential is shallow? Does it go here or does it go there? Then it's harder, right? Then people would run simulations or they would do expansions, and then it would become harder. If the potential separates very well to minima, for sure it goes here. If it's very, very shallow, for sure it goes here. But in the middle, it becomes hard to know when do I start flowing here, when do I flow there? And what would be the large BF? But the idea is that there are many models flow here, many models flow here, but there are way less things that can happen at large distances than can happen at up here, right? Up here I have Ising model, then I have Ising model with nearest neighbors. Close to the same thing, right? So I have infinitely many things I can do up here, very few things I could do down here. Right? The Gaussian model was an example. It needs to be rotational invariant. It was Q squared plus M squared. What else could it be? You can add one more term that needs to be rotational invariant. You can add Q to the 4th. Okay, but that's irrelevant at large distances, so you cannot do anything more. So you are, it's dead, right? You don't have freedom to do more. That's an example. Okay, so that's the picture that goes there. Okay, so. So now we introduce the last topic of the lecture until Friday. I think Friday I would like to do a general overview like the first time, summarizing a little bit. So today and two lectures on Thursday, we are going to describe self-avoiding walks, which I remind you are walks where the path avoids each other, avoids itself. And so the path, this or this, is forbidden. And we think of this as, we can think of this as some big polymer. Right? So there's some big polymer, and the polymer has some thickness and some or some big DNA molecule, and it doesn't need, like to be on top of each other. It occupies space. Okay, so let me give you a roadmap of what I would like to do. I'm not sure if we are going to do everything that I would like to do, but here is what we would like to do. So first, let's introduce some counting problems, define some quantities related to counting of these guys. Then we will solve some simple subclass of self-avoiding walks. Then we will estimate the large distance statistics by a normalization group argument, like we did for the usual walks. And then we will explore what's called Flory's argument, which is also kind of RG-like, which for the same large distance statistics of these polymers and that's very cute. You will see this Flory's argument is chemistry-like argument for estimating the density of these polymers. It's quite interesting. Okay, so let's see if we could solve these two points today. Okay, so let's introduce some quantities related to self-avoiding walks. So let's have our walk, and let's suppose we put the walk on a two-dimensional lattice or on a lattice. And it cannot self-intersect, so this could be a path. Bad idea. And then, after all this path, there is a separation. There is some distance, r. And here we have, let's say we have n steps. Okay, so let's introduce a couple of quantities. In this picture. One could be, for example, how does the radius, this r, how does it scale, another critical exponent, how does it scale with the number of steps? So this is yet another critical exponent, like the ones we saw there. And we already encountered it in the Ising model, right? So that's another critical exponent here. And we encountered it in the Gaussian model and in the random walk. So what was it in the random walk? How did the radius scale with the number of steps? One half, right? So let's remember that we had before that for the usual random walk, this typical size r went like square root of n. Right? Unless we have bias, but if we have bias, it's like ballistic, right? If we have a bias, then in practice we are going like this. And then this r here was proportional to n, if it's just ballistic. And therefore, what do you expect for this nu in this self-avoiding walks?
Somewhere between.
Exactly, something between. It should not be ballistic, but it should be bigger than square root of n, because they cannot self-intersect, so they will grow more. Right? So we expect nu to be somewhere between 1 and 1/2, right? Where this is just the unrestricted random walk, and this would be just ballistic motion. And so we expect the value to be somewhere in between. So what would you guess if it's in between? 1/2 and 1? So you would guess 3/4 in 2 dimensions, that's true. But you probably would not guess the three dimensions. So it's 0.5876 in 3 dimensions. And it's 1/2 in D, bigger or equal than 4. We will see these results during the next lectures, but I wanted to anticipate already. And let's see what does it mean. What does this 1/2 mean? It means that for D bigger than 4, this constraint that they don't self-intersect doesn't matter. So it's like they move randomly, and D is bigger or equal than 4. And I say, oh, and don't self-intersect. And they say, oh, I was not going anyway, right? Or the few times they self-intersect so few times that it doesn't matter. This is something that I'm not sure if in the tutorials we saw, but there is, for example, some simple combinatorics that we can do. How many times does the path self-intersect in the unrestricted random walk? And we see that when D is bigger or equal than 4, it almost never happens. And therefore, D equals 4 is a critical dimension for the self-avoiding walks. When D is bigger than 4, this constraint that you are saying they don't self-intersect is doing nothing because the walks were already not self-intersecting. So a particular toy model is this, what is the probability of going back to the origin? Remember that it was infinite in 2 dimensions, so saying, of course, in 2 dimensions is very important. It always goes back. But when D was very big, this probability was going to 0. So it just doesn't come back to the origin. And more generally, it doesn't self-intersect if the dimension is big.
Is that 1/2 exact then, or approximately?
It depends how you define, but in D it's equal to 4, there is some log correction. In D bigger than 4, it's exact. Okay. But if I define if I define as logarithm of R 1 over n limit, I take log, I get nu log n. If I take, right, when n goes to infinity, then it's exact. Then it's exactly 1/2 in D bigger or equal than 4. Okay, so that's something. That's one example of a nice quantity that we would like to learn about. The other one could be, what is the number of self-avoiding walks with n steps? And for example, let's see what this would be. If D is equal to 2, how many there are with one step? How many paths there are with one step? We are in D equals to 2. How many options do I have? 4. How many paths are there with 2 steps? 12, which is 4 times 3, right? So again, why? Because I go and then I just decide where to go afterwards, and there were 3 options, right? What about the next, when n is equal to 3? Yeah, whatever this number is times 3, right? 4 times 3 times 3, because now here I have 3 options, right? At each of these guys, right? And what about n bigger or equal than n equals to 4? It's hard, right? Because now it depends. If I go here, I have three options. But if I went here, now I cannot go there. I only have two options, right? So starting here, this counting is hard. And so a quantity we could ask is, right, so n bigger or equal than 4, it's hard. We can, of course, enumerate very easily many of them. That's a nice problem, actually, to do in a computer. If you never played with such things, I recommend. But a quantity we could define is, say, let's take the number of paths, and let's say that it grows with mu to the n. And then another nice quantity we could ask is, what is mu? How does it go with the number of paths? So let's make a bound. Let's bound this mu. Let's try to work out an upper and lower bound for this mu. Okay, so tell me something. Tell me one of the two, an upper or a lower bound for this number of paths.
Lower bound.
But tell me what you are telling me. Which one? Upper or lower bound? Left, right, or left? Give me one.
Right
here? You say four. Let's even do it in D dimensions. Tell me in D dimensions even. Which one?
The upper bound is 2D or
2D minus 1. 2D minus 1, right? So let's even write an even, okay, 2D minus 1, but we can do better here. We can say that the number of paths with n, right, is smaller than, at the first step, I had D options. I had actually 2D options, right? And then after the first step, I could say that I have 2D minus 1 because I cannot go back to the power n. Those are paths where I go, first direction I choose whatever, like 4 there, and then I don't go back, right? So indeed, those are a lot of paths, and they include all self-avoiding walks, but they include also walks that are not self-avoiding. And therefore, this is true, right? No self-avoiding walks go back. So this describes all walks. These are all paths that do not do this, where this is go and come back. They do whatever they want, but they don't go and come back. Definitely, self-avoiding walks cannot do this. So this number is, the number of self-avoiding walks is smaller than this. Okay, so let's work out now a bound. And that implies, for large mu, that implies this upper bound. Now, what about the lower bound here? What about some paths that for sure don't self-intersect? Good. If I just use positive for all dimensions, for all directions, if I just go in the positive direction, I never self-intersect, right? So if I have in two dimensions, is what you were telling, I just go in this. So at each position, I choose two options only. Or in three dimensions, if there is, I could also go in this direction, right? But I never go in the negative direction. Then I never self-intersect. And how many options there are? There are d to the n. Because at each option, now I only have d. And so this mu is some number between d and 2d minus 1. And in particular, in d equals to 2, this number is therefore in d equals 2. we kind of know it's something between 2 and 3. Maybe it's 2.6. Something like this. Okay, so what I would like to do now is to compute, to solve some models of self-avoiding walks that are easier and where we can compute all this. We can compute these MNs, we can compute this radius, we can just solve the models exactly in the same way that we can solve the one-dimensionalizing model or the two-dimensionalizing model. And these are models which are called never look back or never walk back self-avoiding walks. So let's define what they are. And they are not as trivial as those that just move in positive direction, but they are simple. So let's suppose we have a model where, like, we have a boundary, and then it's like we have a flower that starts and goes up and goes in any possible direction, but it never goes down. So the rule is that never goes down, but it can go. So this is not okay, but it can go up, left, or right. That's okay. So you see, it's not exactly just up and left. That was the trivial case, just goes up, left, up, left. You just choose whatever you want. So you can go up, left, right, and so on, and you go from the origin until the end. And at the end, you can draw a small flower. And that's our flower. Okay. So that's it. And so now, we could compute the number of such walks, right? And we will show that the number of such walks goes like 1 plus square root of 2 to the number n. Okay, that's what we are going to show next. And notice that because these walks are self-avoiding walks, they improve our lower bounds. Right? Because these are definitely self-avoiding walks. And 1 plus square root of 2 is bigger than 2. So already by just solving this very simple model and showing that, it immediately allows us to improve this bound, right? And say that we can do better than this. We can replace this by 1 plus square root of 2. Because these are definitely self-avoiding walks. But they are not all self-avoiding walks in two dimensions. So by establishing that result, we already put a bound which is better. Mu now is between 1 plus square root of 2 and 3. Right? So it's between 2.4 and 3. So just by solving this very simple model. So it's almost a self-avoiding walk, but it just goes up or left or right. So the number of such walks. Okay. So let's compute this MN. And in the remaining, and in the, and yeah, I would like to solve this problem. Okay. So we can say the following. So there are many ways of solving this problem, and we will solve it in a few different ways, perhaps one or two different ways, that I think are quite instructive. One way is by thinking, like we thought for the Ising model and like we did for the random walk, that this process is Markovian. So if I know where I am, I continue growing. So if I counted up to some point, I just continue going. Right? Now, what I can do at step n depends if I reached position n vertically or horizontally. Because you see that if I reach it vertically, I can choose to turn left or turn right. But if the last step was horizontal, I cannot go back. I need to either continue or go up. So what I can do next depends on how I ended. Did I end up there vertically or horizontally? So that suggests that we should say that we should split this and say that Mn is the total number of paths that end up horizontally after n steps plus the number of paths that end up vertically after n steps. And now let's write a recursion relation. So this is the number of paths ending add this or this, and these are the number of paths ending with going up. Okay, and now we can immediately write a recursion relation because we can say how many paths are there horizontally or vertically with n plus one steps, n plus one. And we say that how can we end up horizontally? We can end up horizontally either we were already horizontal and then we just continue, or we were vertical and then we have two options to end up horizontal. And so what do you want to write here? If I say that the number of such paths is going to be proportional to both Vn and to Hn. And what numbers do you want to put here? So how many paths are there that end up horizontally? So if I remove that step, it came from either a vertical or an horizontal path, right? So if it was ending horizontal, I only have one option. I continue in the same direction. So coefficient one. But if it was vertical, it ends horizontal if I turn left or if I turn right. So there is a two. Do you agree? What about the second line? Please tell me. How can I end up vertically? I could be vertical before or horizontal. And what coefficient should I put? So 1 Vienna. Why? Because if I go up, I can, and I want to continue up, I just continue up. And what about here? Who thinks it's 2?
1.
Because I'm horizontal, then I complete it by going up. I don't have two options. I don't have up or down. Remember, it's only up. So 1. Okay, and now we are done. Because now we just, if I know how to go from n to n plus one, I just do it many times. And now how do we do it many times? Many ways. For example, transfer matrix. We can say that if I construct a vector, v and h, whatever, at position, at time n plus one, this is equal to some transfer matrix T times V and N and H at position N, where the matrix T is equal to, so vertical is the second line, 1, 1, and H, 2, 1. Right? And therefore, my V H after n steps is just my transfer matrix raised to the n power, in other words, T dot T dot T dot T, times V H, let's do the, yeah, okay, whatever. If I put 0, I don't think I like it, yeah. Yeah, let's put n plus 1, and let's say after one step. And after one step, the only option I have is to be here, and I go vertically. Do you agree? Yes? And therefore, at the start, this vector is this initial condition 1, 0. Right? After one step, I end up vertically.
Not go to the left or right at the beginning?
Here? I could. Doesn't matter. It's a choice, the boundary conditions, right? I decide like this. It's a flower. When it starts growing, it has lots of energy. It wants to go up, right? Okay. And therefore, what do we want to do? We have this vector, and we want to sum these two components. So what I want to compute is 1, 1, transfer matrix to the power n, and then 1, 0. So this is our m, n. I put n minus 1 there, I shift by 1. So that's my equation. Okay. So all I need to do is compute this quantity. And I have mn. But now, how do we estimate the large n behavior? Usual thing, we diagonalize this matrix, and it will have two eigenvalues, and it's the biggest one that dominates this computation. Okay? So let's do it there. So if I say that my matrix, let me use the following. There are many ways of doing. But for example, I can say that my Mn is equal to the vector 1, 1. And it doesn't matter. This could be, it could be anything, as we will see. But then dot t to the n minus 1 and dot and then the vector 1, 0. This is the vector 1, 0. But I write it as a linear combination. It's C1 times the vector which has the largest eigenvalue for this matrix plus, I can put C plus, plus C minus times the vector with the smallest eigenvalue, where this notation is that T acting on these vectors plus minus are equal to lambda plus minus times vector plus minus. So it's a better basis. Okay. Because once I use this basis, the action on T just multiplies each vector by lambda plus to the n and lambda minus to the n. Right? And therefore, let's compute this eigenvalue in a second. But before we compute, let's notice that this is therefore equal. Let's call this guy the vector end. And this would be the vector start. Just to emphasize that it doesn't matter what they are. Because what do we conclude? Then this C plus, right, is just nothing but the overlap of plus star. Right? If I dot this with plus, I extract this coefficient. And similarly for C minus. And now, you see, if absolute value of lambda plus is bigger than the absolute value of lambda minus, and if n is much bigger than 1, I don't care about this term, because this term peaks lambda minus to the n. This peaks lambda plus to the n, which is much bigger. Right? And therefore, I get that the result is some constant, and that constant is the following. It's n times plus times plus times start. In other words, it's the overlap with the endpoint and starting point of the biggest eigenvalue. And provided these overlaps are not zero, which generically is true, it's some constant. The only thing we have to make sure is that it's not zero. Okay, and indeed we can check it's not zero. So this is just some constant. And then the interesting part is just lambda plus to the n. Okay, there is n minus 1 here, so let me put a 1 over lambda plus here as well. Then it's just some constant times lambda plus to the n. Okay. And therefore, this lambda plus to the n is mu. So mu is the biggest eigenvalue of the matrix. Okay, so let's compute the eigenvalues now. So this eigenvalue is a 2 by 2 matrix. 1 minus lambda, 1, what is the matrix? 2, 1 minus lambda. right? And therefore, the determinant of this matrix is 1 minus lambda squared minus 2. And therefore, lambda is equal to 1 plus or minus square root of 2. Right? And so this, the biggest one is indeed with plus sign. So lambda plus, in particular, indeed, lambda plus is square root of 2 plus 1, which is what we wanted to show. So as soon as I write it as a transfer matrix, right away, we know that what we should do is the transfer matrix evolves. And whenever it evolves, something proportional to vector plus grows, something proportional to vector minus compared to that one decreases. And therefore, I just keep the plus evolution that dominates, and I get the estimate for the number of paths. Okay? So that's how we would solve it with transfer matrix, right? And of course, the first line is an exact computation, right? So notice that in the first here, right? This is exact, right? So I now just replace here, right? I can just replace this by lambda plus to the n minus 1 times plus 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 the same thing with minus, right? And then I expand here and I get two terms, one like that and one with minus, and that's exact, right? So this plus the same thing with minus, but this guy is much smaller than the other one. But with this one plus the same thing with minus, this is exact. This is the exact number of paths, right? No approximation here. It is just how many such paths there are. We just solved it exactly for finite n, and when n is big, we estimated mu, and this gave us a better bound. So this, right, is 2.41, and so we know that mu is between 2.41 and 3. Yeah? Okay, very good. So this introduces a model. So something nice that we did not compute here that we could have is what is the average distance after all these steps, right? We could have asked in this case, what do we get for this average? What is in this toy model, this average r, right? As n to the nu, and we could ask, what is nu equal to for these flower type models, right? Should be somehow between 1/2 and 1. So we could ask nu of the flower, what is this nu? Right? So self-evaluating. Can you guess what it is? That's the last thing I'll ask you today. Then we are done.
2/3.
Sorry? Something? What do you think it should be? So we computed mu for that model, that was 1 plus square root of 2. And now we could ask what is nu for this model. It's easy. Once if I tell you the answer, it's, yeah, of course. Let me ask you again, when did we get this 1/2?
Unbiased.
Unconstrained random walk. When did we get this one? Biased random walk, right? Ballistic or just random walk, but with bias. Yeah, that's right. What do you think we will get there for new?
So we have one, like one across the number of steps.
Sorry?
We're going to get something closer to one, I guess. It's acting ballistically.
Exactly. Right? There is a bias. It goes up. It doesn't go down. So nu is one. That's it. There is, we will see. We will compute it exactly next time. but it has to be, right? So if you look from far away, a flower that goes up, right? That's okay, right? Even forests from far away, the trees go up. So indeed, there is a bias. So another way of saying is that on average, roughly half of the steps go up and half go left or right. Right? So those half that go up are enough to give n over 2 for r. And therefore, r needs to go like n. That's enough. So you could ask, what's the average height? It grows like n. What's the average displacement to the side? It grows like square root of n. Because it's no bias in this direction and very bias in this direction. So yeah, the y component grows with n. The x component grows with square root of n. We will see it next time carefully. Okay.